Not too many years ago, in fact it was in 1936, a poet in England wrote these words.
Time's ambition, huge as space, will hang its flags in distant worlds.
Today, the intensity of human invention is bringing the poet's prediction nearer to fulfillment than he probably ever imagined. But we didn't finish the quote. Let's have it again, in full.
Time's ambition, huge as space, will hang its flags in distant worlds, and on this world, in years as distant.
Today, that last prediction is being exposed to an exciting challenge. The distance could be much shorter than the poet believed, and the following program will try to show why.
On October 24th, 1945, the United Nations formally began to use many and varied means towards the attainment of two ends, peace and human welfare. This program concentrates on just one, the sharing of skills for the promotion of social progress and better standards of life for all peoples. Ladies and gentlemen, United Nations Radio presents Time's Ambition.
Perhaps it would be clearer, if more prosaic, to say not time's ambition, but mankind's. Mankind's ambition throughout all time. And this includes, well, for one thing, there's our desire to make known the unknown, to penetrate the mysterious. This has always been part of our ambition, no matter how far back you go. For instance, one can easily imagine some shaggy Neanderthal dragging his reluctant wife down to the river and saying,
"All right, get on that log, shove off, and go see what it's like round the bend down there."
"But how am I going to get back again?"
"I said shove off. I'll think about that later." "Oh, well, back to the old cave."
These days, such sweet simplicity is out of bounds. We can no longer be casual about our probes into the unknown. In the last months of 1957, for example, we heard the beeps of Sputnik 1, the sound of our first small footsteps towards the distant worlds. Their significance was not lost on us. In less than a year, it was the subject of an international debate at the 13th session of the United Nations General Assembly.
"We must make every effort to dedicate outer space exclusively to constructive pursuits."
The voice of the late John Foster Dulles of the United States, and of Andrei Gromyko of the Soviet Union.
"Everything depends on what direction is given to the mastery of cosmic space, whether it is directed towards solving the problems of peaceful construction or serves the ends of destruction and war."
And the voice, too, of Selwyn Lloyd of the United Kingdom.
"We hope that this undertaking can be kept apart from the disarmament problem, and free from the international differences which beset that problem."
Thus, while we check the heartbeats of orbiting dogs and monkeys, and while pressure-suited men are trained to follow them, we search for the formula that will keep the heavens free of strife. But what about the rest of time's ambition? If the penetration of the cosmic mystery is the latest expression of our appetite for the unknown, what about our age-old ambition to live in freedom from poverty, ignorance, and disease? When the Second World War ended and the UN began its work, we realized that if we can no longer be casual about the way we apply our technical knowledge, we can't be casual about economic and social problems either. Thus, in the UN Charter, the nations pledged themselves
to promote social progress and better standards of life,
and
to employ international machinery for the economic and social advancement of all peoples.
This, 14 years ago, was the stated ambition. And the response?
We are recalling the 241st and 242nd plenary meetings of the fourth session of the General Assembly, held at Lake Success, New York, 16th of November, 1949. The Assembly has before it Resolution 304, authorizing an expanded program of technical assistance for the economic development of underdeveloped countries. Among the speakers on that occasion, Mr. P.C. Chang of China.
主席先生，技术协助究竟仅仅是一种方法。
Mr. Chairman, technical assistance is a way of helping the economically underdeveloped countries to achieve their economic, political, and social independence.
Dr. Victor Belaunde of Peru.
Y debo ahora decir a nombre de mi patria que aprueba entusiastamente.
In the name of my country, I support enthusiastically the resolution on technical assistance, economic development.
Mr. Karmakar of India.
Technical assistance is an imperative need in any scheme of the development of underdeveloped countries. The expanded program provides for such assistance in ample measure.
Mr. Lapi of France.
L'Assemblée se trouve devant un programme qui réunit un double mérite.
The Assembly is confronted with a program of twofold merit. It is with enthusiasm that France welcomes it, as do other nations.
Mr. Arutyunyan of the Soviet Union.
Наша симпатия, наша помощь, помощь Советского Союза будет на стороне этих.
Our sympathy, our help, will be on the side of these small countries which endeavor to pursue a policy to fulfill the purposes of technical assistance.
Mr. Compton of the United States.
It is precisely because this program is a cooperative pooling of wits, wisdom, and skills in economic development in which all countries are able to participate, that all may give as well as receive.
When Resolution 304 was adopted, the President of the Fourth Session of the General Assembly, General Carlos P. Romulo of the Philippines, said,
"The progress of technical assistance is one of the most constructive acts of international statesmanship ever taken under the auspices of the United Nations. And we should all feel proud that this is going to be recorded as one of the achievements of the present session of the General Assembly."
That was 10 years ago. And during those years,
since the point early in our history when governments became aware of the facilities available to them, there has been no lack of demand for the services the program has offered.
This is Mr. David Owen, Executive Chairman of the United Nations Technical Assistance Board.
During the course of the years, 140 countries and territories have requested and received help in some form or another, the overwhelming majority of them having an estimated per capita national income of less than $150 a year. Through the voluntary contributions which we have received from governments every year, we will have spent, by the end of 1959, over $235 million to meet thousands of requests.
And, Mr. Owen continues,
there is no doubt that the backbone of the program consists of the more than 8,000 men and women who have been sent out as technical experts. In fact, it was estimated that last year, 75% of the resources of the program were used to send these people into the field.
And who are these people? They're people like these.
Frederick Bath speaking, on loan from United Kingdom to United Nations Technical Assistance Administration for service as housing policy advisor with the Turkish government.
Sou Nair Maria Becker, professora brasileira, estacionada em Ankara, Turquia.
This is Dr. Wilhelm Spitz of Austria, speaking from the World Health Organization's Regional Office for Africa.
Bergljot Gudim, helsesøster, Verdenshelseorganisasjon.
I am Mohammed Assar, sanitary engineer from Tehran, a member of World Health Organization working in Ethiopia.
Eugenio Vaccarone, esperto della FAO per la cultura del pioppo, già dell'Istituto di Pioppicultura.
My name is William Cox and I'm an architect. As part of the United Nations Technical Assistance, I have been working with the School of Architecture at the Middle East Technical University.
Just a few from the 8,000 who have served over the last 10 years, 8,000 drawn from every region of the globe. For technical assistance is not a one-way street. It's an alternating, not a direct current. As the United States delegate at that meeting of the General Assembly back in 1949 pointed out,
every country is more advanced than its neighbors in some field of economic development. Each country, no doubt, can provide training facilities or expert advice in some line of economic endeavor.
And so, in the records of technical assistance, you find exchanges of skill running east to west and west to east.
Dr. Shao Wen Ling, Chinese fish farming expert, recruited by the Food and Agriculture Organization, visiting America at the request of the Fish and Wildlife Service of the Department of Agriculture to investigate fish farming problems in the United States.
Dr. Douglas Toffelmeyer, American orthopedic surgeon, recruited by the United Nations and the World Veterans Federation, helping to train Indonesian doctors in modern physical rehabilitation techniques at the Solo Center in Java.
And the effect of all this, its impact? One can look at the whole concept of technical assistance and its practice from different angles. There is the human side.
Over the years, we have had more than our share of dramatic stories to report,
says Mr. David Owen.
I like to think of the experience of the construction engineer sent by the United Nations to one country in the Far East. After a considerable time spent supervising the construction of a dam, he met with an accident and was taken to a hospital in a city some 10 miles from the project site. On their one day off, the local workmen, a large number of them, walked those 10 miles in the heat of the sun to visit the foreigner in the hospital. When they got there, they couldn't speak to him because of the difference in language, but they came so that he might know they appreciated what he was doing.
There is indeed the human side. And there is often, too, immediate and tangible evidence of the results of a technical assistance project. Take the landlocked Latin American country, Paraguay. For years, Paraguayans were virtually isolated from other countries and from each other. As late as 1955, a businessman in the capital, Asuncion, who wanted to make a telephone call to, say, Rome, had first to fly 600 miles to Buenos Aires in Argentina. But things are changing. One day in May last year, a teletype machine in the cable room on the 20th floor of the UN building in New York began to tap out a message. Office of Dispatch, Asunción, Paraguay. Addressee, Technical Assistance Board, United Nations. Message reads,
glad report this cablegram uses first direct circuit between Paraguay, United Nations, United States. Stop. Made possible by determined action Paraguayan government and cooperation of International Telecommunications Union advisors, thus contributing help Paraguay counteract landlocked conditions through telecommunications. Stop.
You can, as we said, look at technical assistance from different angles. But to concentrate solely on the human side, or to focus exclusively on a single type of project, is to get an unbalanced picture of the whole. 10 years of experience have shown that projects tend to be most effective when a number of different, though related ones, are carried out as part of an overall national development plan. The value of this integrated approach is gradually being recognized more and more, particularly where newly independent nations are taking their place on the world scene and where old nations, bypassed by the torrent of modern progress, are working to catch up. In Africa, for example.
We are in the piazza, the hilltop hut of the Ethiopian capital, Addis Ababa. On one corner, a modern 5-story office building, terracotta in color. If you go in and consult the tenants directory by the elevator, you'll find one line reading, UN Technical Assistance Board Resident Representative.
This is Mr. Theodore Lilienfeld. He's the link between the government, the UN, and the specialized agencies. He's the man to give you the complete picture.
Here in Ethiopia, we have six specialized agencies who work here, plus the Technical Assistance Administration of the United Nations.
And the precise activities, or at least some of them?
We have here established a public administration institute, which is part of the activities of the Ethiopian government. The second agency working here in Ethiopia, especially connected with agriculture, is the FAO, the Food and Agricultural Organizations. We have here a team of four veterinarians who are busy fighting the animal diseases prevalent in this country, which at present make it impossible to export meat to other countries. The next organization represented here is the UNESCO, the United Nations Educational, Scientific, Cultural Organization. This organization is running a center which is firstly concerned with fundamental education. And then I come to an organization which is most important for Ethiopia. It is the International Civil Aviation Organization. I would say that practically 100% or 90% of all employees in the civil aviation department of the Ethiopian government have been manned by recruits who have been trained by the International Civil Aviation Organization. The next organization is WHO, the World Health Organization. This organization is busy in establishing malaria eradication teams all over the country. Then we have another organization, the International Telecommunications Union, who is running telecommunications school. We train their telephonists and radio telegraphists and repairmen and have approximately trained 500 people.
A pattern of development from the sound foundation of efficient public administration through agriculture, education, health, transport and communications. Now switch to the opposite, the west coast of the African continent.
We're about a couple of miles from the main shopping and business section of Accra, capital of Ghana. There's a cluster, a compound of long, low buildings, corrugated asbestos roofs, louvered windows. In some are government departments, ministries. Outside one, a signboard, white letters on a blue ground, UN Technical Assistance Board.
This contains the office of an assistant resident representative, Mr. Kura Satrap.
The role of the personnel of the United Nations and its specialized agencies presently in Ghana ranges from the top-level advisory role to technicians contributing skill to specialized technical projects.
And some specifics, Mr. Satrap?
An FAO specialist on range management, Mr. Ian Blair, is advising the government on improvement of grassland, which would induce the growth of a healthy cattle industry. A development economist, Mr. David Dinor, attached to the Ministry of Finance, is concentrating on establishment and organization of a budget bureau. Another United Nations advisor, Mr. Brett, has assisted the government in drawing up regulations on real estate valuation and has set up a training course for their valuers. As an advisor to the Ministry of Trade and Industries, Mr. Philip Stuchen is consulted with respect to the government policies and industrial and investment promotion, as well as promotion of foreign trade. Among the personnel of the United Nations and its specialized agencies, Professor Arthur Lewis has played the most influential part in drawing up of the second five-year development plan, and as economic advisor to the Prime Minister, was consulted on various economic activities and policies of enduring significance.
A similar pattern, from beef cattle to government budgets, particularly budgets. For it's in the nature of underdevelopment that limited resources have to be used with care and skill in meeting the enormous demands as effectively as possible. Mr. Satrap mentioned Mr. David Dinor, a development economist in Ghana. He has described the budget problem as one of knowing not just what has to be bought, but what is going to be done with the goods and services once they have been bought. In other words, it's a question of knowing just what it is hoped to achieve in each particular field. This, he says, is a trend everywhere these days in budgeting, a trend towards program and performance budgets. Now, in highly developed countries, this presents no great difficulty. But in poorer countries, well, let Mr. Dinor himself explain, as he did to us recently in his office in Accra.
If we decide that because of limited resources, because after all the money that we receive has to be limited by economic needs and exigencies of the Ghanaian economy in this particular case, we would have to make decisions about cutting down on particular expenditures. It wouldn't be just cutting down on wages or salaries or anything of that sort, but it would be cutting down on specific programs. We would then perhaps very heartbreaking decisions of reducing number of children in school or reducing the number of hospital beds or perhaps something different, reducing the quality of the service that we are providing. Let's say instead of having a luxurious hospital or a very luxurious school building, we would have to reduce the quality and have something which will be perhaps inferior but still providing the service needed at a particular moment in the country.
At this point, let's pause and take stock. We hope this program, so far, has given some impression of the range and methods of technical assistance, or technical cooperation, as it really should be called. But there's much we haven't said, particularly on its cooperative nature. There is, for instance, the way the cost of a project is shared. The receiving governments always match and generally exceed the amount of international money involved. And there's something else as well, a deeply personal element which, ultimately, may well be of more lasting importance than accounted costs or reported accomplishments. Technical assistance, no matter what form it may take, health, engineering, statistics, agriculture, in the end concerns people, not just in the sense that it's a means towards a better material life for people, but because it can nourish those two intangibles, mutual understanding and respect. The qualities that are the essence of cooperation. We'd like to give two illustrations. Before an expert goes into the field to share his knowledge, he's briefed. But no briefing can ever be complete, and many an expert has found in the field that in helping to change things there, he has changed himself. Listen to Professor Green, an educationist sent by UNESCO to Ceylon.
We who come here as experts are experts in our own country. And we arrive here, and we don't understand the new social setting. We have to, as it were, redevelop our expertness. And may it not be that the engineers with whom you have to work, you feel that they're potentially good engineers, but they don't achieve the results you might anticipate. Now, isn't that because they are up against social problems or cultural problems, which you don't understand, just as I in my job feel that this fellow ought to do better than this, but he doesn't do it for reasons that I don't understand because I don't know enough about the pattern under which he lives.
When Professor Green recorded those words not long ago in Colombo, he was talking with some other experts on mission in Ceylon, and they had similar thoughts. There was, for instance, a WHO nurse from Finland, Miss Taritu Taylor.
When I came here, I thought I knew quite a lot about nursing, but I have since noticed that I have had to start again to learn and to try to adjust what I have learned before to this special situation here.
And there was Mr. Das Gupta of India, an expert on problems of under- and unemployment, on mission for the International Labour Organization.
I was particularly confronted with this problem that the concepts that I was trying to apply in the beginning were the concepts suitable to highly industrialized countries. And I soon discovered that they had very little application, even meaning, in a social and economic structure as we find in Ceylon. And this thing then became very important, this adjustment of the techniques to the situation.
And with this adjustment, a human personal understanding of the difficulties faced by the countries now striving for a better standard of life. But this understanding is not something which only experts in the field may gain. Part of the alternating current character of technical assistance is the fellowship program. Some 14,000 fellowships have been awarded by the United Nations and the agencies during the last 10 years for training purposes. And, as Mr. David Owen points out,
like every phase of the program, fellowships awards have implications which go well beyond the purely technical aspect.
And he cites a case.
Last week, I received a copy of a letter which had been sent to the Danish National Committee for Technical Assistance by a group of young Indonesian men who had been trained in Denmark. They wrote of their great appreciation for what they had learnt about marine navigation and how they intended to use this knowledge. They also wrote of how they had learnt to like and to understand the people of their host country. The letter was written, incidentally, in what my Danish friends tell me is perfect Danish.
This, then, is technical assistance. Started a decade ago as an experiment in the provision of skills on an international scale, it has grown into a mature, highly experienced, and indispensable part of the whole complex pattern of economic development. But only a part. Know-how in a vacuum isn't very useful. You could be the best steelmaker in the world, but if you can't use the stuff after you've made it, what's the point? So the objectives of technical assistance must, and do, fit in with all the other international efforts to promote, in the words of the UN Charter,
social progress and better standards of life in larger freedom.
And the fact that there is today this growing sense of, call it what you will, cohesion, interdependence, community, solidarity, the fact that it exists today in the face of human need is probably the most significant fact of the age. Despite all the dangerous, distracting, and wasteful tensions of our time, it is possible to detect the beginning of a new age, an age in which time's ambition can be realized, and not, perhaps, as the poet predicted, in years as distant as the stars.
You have been listening to Time's Ambition, a program for United Nations Day reviewing 10 years of technical assistance as one of the major instruments in the practical application of the economic and social provisions of the Charter. Time's Ambition was written and produced by the international staff of United Nations Radio.